Let's see, you were talking about
Arizona.
Yeah, when we finished reel number one, you said you had went out of Kingman, 28 miles out of Kingman, Arizona, for U.S. smelting in 1913, March of 1913.
The name of the mining camp was Gold Road.
Gold Road.
It was a gold load mine. And it was 3 miles from another gold mining camp known as Oatman, O-A-T-M-A-N.
Yeah, Oatman is a... Mm-hmm. I've been to Oatman. I've been to Kingman, too.
Yes.
And it, for U.S. smelting, did you office work,
well,
office procedures, accounting,
and starting
in,
I was a timekeeper and general clerk, and wasn't but a short time until I was been there probably 3-4 years, and I was in charge of the office then. I don't know just how to get started on this, but I wasn't there very long until I was looking at the ladies, and there were very few of them there. There was one good-looking gal there that I was looking at considerable. Her name was Lucille, and competition was pretty keen, but I was successful, and I think she was about 17 and I was 20 or 21. But we were married in Needles, California. Oh, by the way, when I first went to Arizona, I went to the smelting company, owned a mill and smelter at Needles. They had a complex ore that they mined at chloride. You probably know where that is outside of Kingman. The Santa Fe built a spur to chloride and just to ship the ore back down to the main line and to Needles for the mill and smelter.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked in Needles for a very short time, really. They transferred me down there and was going to want me to replace the man who was at Needles. But Needles was so doggone hot, you could see your tracks in the asphalt pavement as you walked to work. The smelter was down near the river, and I was living in town.
It's terribly hot there.
And it was just too hot, so I told them I didn't want it. If they didn't have anything else, I was moving on, and they moved me back to Gold Road. And it wasn't very long till I was then in charge of the Gold Road office. The company had 3 or 4 mining operations. Besides the mill and smelter at Needles, they had the chloride mine and the Gold Road mine and Banner and Stockton Hill mines. They had quite a few.
Mm-hmm.
They were mostly gold mines, although chloride was a lead zinc mostly. And the general manager of those operations lived at Gold Road at the headquarters. So I moved back to Gold Road, and it was a elevation of about 3,500 feet in the at Gold Road. And the nights were cool, even in the summertime you had to have a cover. The days were hot, sure, but it was a nice, healthy climate.
Yes.
I enjoyed it very much.
Did you have snow in the winter, ever?
Well, once, while I was there, we had a little snow. I remember the rose bush in front of the house, and the roses were in bloom. We had a light snow, and you had to get out and look at it quick, or else it was all gone.
Yeah.
That's the only time.
I can remember one time like that in Tucson.
Yeah.
About 2 o'clock in the morning, my mother woke us all up to rush out and see the
snow. Didn't even bother the rose. It just kept right on.
Yeah, it kept on blooming.
It was a big, rambling rose bush in the front.
Yeah. So you went back to the Gold Load Mine, and where the
Gold
office...
Road.
Gold Road.
It was a Gold Load, yes, but it's called, the name of it was Gold Road.
Oh, Gold Road.
All one word. Gold Road
Mine. Were the office manager? Let's get back to Lucille. You said you were kind of eyeing this good-looking girl. Did she live there?
Yes, her mother and family moved to... her mother's husband, a man by the name of Hughes, moved to Gold Road with her mother, and she had two sisters and two brothers, and they all moved there. And that's where I met her, of course. And we married, I don't know, probably, well, shortly after. I mean, we didn't waste any time, really.
Went to Needles and were married.
Yeah. Then all the kids were born in, well, born in Oatman. There was a hospital in Gold Road, but it was a, up on the hill. It was more for mine emergencies. There was a doctor and a nurse there, it's true, and the doctor was a doctor for all the families there. But most of the kids were born in Oatman in the hospital. It was only 3 miles to Oatman, and they had a better hospital there. And
now, one of your sons is Lee Link here, in, who lives here in Fairbanks.
That's right, yes. Alaska Architectural and Engineering.
And then a daughter is Helen Atkinson.
Helen Atkinson. Another daughter is Shirley Carlson.
These three live in Fairbanks.
Those three, yes. And, oh, don't forget Jim Moody in Anchorage. I consider him one of the family.
Oh, do you?
Oh, yes. He's a fine boy.
Did you rear him as a son, or?
Well, he was rather young when Alaska and I were married. Her husband died, Edson.
Oh, Moody. I see. This is Alaska's son.
Hmm?
Alaska's son.
Yeah, he's Alaska's son. I mean, she married Edson Moody, and he passed away, and she was a widow.
So, I see. He Jim is your
little,
stepson.
He was a little bit of a... I consider him part
your,
of the family.
Your boy, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a nice kid.
And then you have a son.
I have a
Donald, I think.
Donald is a doctor in the in San Mateo, California, in that in the Bay Area. He lives in San Mateo, but they have four or five different offices that they use there.
And were all the four your four children, were they all born in Oatman?
No, Shirley was born in Gold Road. I don't know why, but she was born at home in Gold Road. They happened to be a doctor there, I mean, and they had some gal who was a nurse, and Shirley was born at home. But the rest of them were born in Oatman, I think.
That really surprises me. Helen and I were born pretty close to... We've been neighbors for years out there in the hill, you know, off and on, and we were born pretty close together.
Same state, anyhow.
Yeah. Well, compared to Alaska, Oatman's not too far from Flagstaff, you know.
No, that's true.
Distance-wise.
Yeah.
Then you stayed there in Gold Road until you came to Alaska? Or did you move?
No. I left Arizona in 1925 and went to Eureka, Colorado, which is about 9 miles above Silverton in the San Juan area. The camp and mill is at around 10,000 feet, and the mine is 13,000 feet in elevation.
This was still with U.S. Smelting?
Yes. Well, it was known as the Sunnyside Mine, but the U.S. Smelting owned the Gold Road and owned the Sunnyside. Those are just subsidiary names. Mm-hmm. And I was there for 3 years. And came to Alaska from Colorado, really. Now, during the first winter there, Shirley, who was probably around 6 years old, became quite ill and necessary to get her out of the high altitude. And we took her to Pasadena, where my sister and my mother was living with my sister there. And she missed a year of school and went around there in the sun and recouped and then went to school in California for a while. And then the wife and kids came up to Colorado for, I guess they came up for first day when school started after I went up. They were there about 2 years, and then on account of Shirley moving down, they moved to California, lived there, and I stayed about a year after that before I went to Alaska. before I came here.
Before you came here. So you came to Alaska then about 1928?
March of 1928.
And when you came, did your whole family come with you then?
No, they were in school in California. They stayed there. When I first got here, they wasn't... the FE company didn't have a place for me. And of course, like everybody else coming up here, I didn't know whether I was going to stay or not, but O.J. Eggleston was the general manager. And he built two rooms on the bottom of the Noyes house, you know. It was a three-story house, and he put two rooms in the bottom of it and fixed it all up very nicely, and family came up just before school started in 1928.
The old Noyes house, is that the one on the corner of Minnie Street? And is that the one you're talking about?
It's on Illinois Street and Minnie on the corner, yes. Yeah. The Undertaker lives there now. But at that time, it was a three-story house built by Noyes, who was quite an old pioneer here and had a sawmill and did some mining, and the company bought him his ground and so forth there. But he had this three-story house, which was a beautiful deal. I mean, he shipped the lumber in, and there wasn't a knot in the wainscoting, you know. On the third floor, they had a pool table, and usually there was another family lived on the second floor. But it was the Noyes house in many ways, and the Link kids moved in there. It was noisy.
Yeah. Well, did you occupy the whole house, or just...
No, just the bottom.
The bottom
the
floor.
Basement and the first floor.
Mm-hmm. It's still a...
It's
handsome.
Only two-story now.
Yeah, but it's still a handsome house,
yes,
I think.
Yes, it is.
And the people who have owned it have kept it.
Well, it was sort of a show place, this Noyes place, for early days.
Whenever I go by there, I always like to...
It's a beautiful place, really.
So that was your first home in Fairbanks?
Yeah, that's right.
And how many years did you live there?
Oh, I don't know. I think in 1936 we moved over into the house that... Erling had vacated. That was right across the street from the office, and lived there until I retired in 58, when we moved over into Fairbanks town.
1958, you retired from the U.S. Melting.
Yeah, January 1st, I think, 1958. Birthday would be December, so I would retire on the first of the month after that, but January the 1st in 58 when I retired.
Now,
that's over 15 years ago.
I know, and you've retired twice since then. Or three times, I don't know.
No. Well, I really only retired three times altogether.
But in Fairbanks, it wasn't called U.S. Smelting, it was called the Fairbanks Exploration
That's
Company.
True, yes.
Subsidiary of U.S.
Yeah, well, later on, when they were organizing buying property and up here, they formed the Fairbanks Exploration Company, a Delaware corporation. But later on, they did change the name of the company to the U.S. Smelting, Refining, and Mining Company. But nobody called it that anymore. It was then and still is the FE Company.
So at the time you came in March of 1928, Old J. Eggleston was the manager.
Yes.
Could you, do you recall the other managers of the company?
Well, there weren't very many. Old J. Eggleston was the manager, and when he left, Roy B. Erling took over. And then James D. Crawford was the manager after Erling. And that's all they had, was three managers. Oh, I'm wrong about that, really, because in the organization and starting in, George Metcalf was in charge of the office before Eggleston. And I met Metcalf and knew him in the, what they call outside.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eggleston, how do you recall how to spell his name?
Egleston.
Yeah, I had it right, but I wasn't sure.
And O.J. was Oliver Jones Eggleston.
Oliver Jones. But George Metcalf preceded Eggleston in the
George Metcalf,
formation period.
Well, Norman Stein's organized the buying of the property up here. You've heard of Norman Stein,
yes.
I'm quite sure. And he was quite a sharp fellow. He really, looking through his record, I've met him, sure, when I first came up. But he was a live wire in getting a company put together and getting it going. But George W. Metcalf was the manager, the first manager.
Okay, but when you came up here in 1928, so when was it that Steins and Metcalf organized?
Well, the Steins was working on this in 24, I believe, buying property and getting organized and getting the construction started. And Metcalf came up here, I don't remember the year, but Metcalf probably was here until Eggleston came up, which must have been, summer of 27, I believe, or fall of 27, Eggleston came up and relieved Metcalf. You see, 28 was the first year the FE Company produced any gold. That's when the dredges, some of them were built, and they were starting to be on production.
27, they were probably building the dredges.
They were building the dredges and other, they built the power plant and the ditch and all the construction work. And by the way, George Rastens was in charge of the constructions, and he was a very fine construction man.
I've met George Rastens. Yeah. My husband knows him, or knew him.
Well.
He used to come up here in the winters later, and I always remember the huge, big raccoon coat that he would wear.
Did, yeah. Yeah, he was a real construction man. I mean, a very fine fellow.
How many dredges, by 1928, how many dredges were there in operation?
I think they had four. I think they had five that year. They were working on them, and I think he completed and had five dredges in operation.
Do you recall where they were?
Goldstream.
Goldstream, naturally.
And Chattanooga had two dredges, one in upper Chattanooga, Clary, and one in the lower. And Goldstream had one big dredge, and then they had a smaller dredge up at around Gilmore or Fox, someplace in there.
Well, didn't they start up on the discovery claim near, you know, Pedro's discovery claim?
Well, that was a small dredge that was put in later on. Maybe I'm wrong, they only had four dredges the first year completed. Then they got a small dredge on Pedro that was number four. It was the smallest of all the dredges.
That was maybe later, a year?
Yes, a year or so later. But
is that Pedro dredge, you say it was a smaller dredge, is that the one that is visible now from the highway and is...
No, the Pedro dredge isn't here. It was shipped to Hogetza.
Hogetza.
No, pardon me. It was shipped to Chicken. Chicken. Oh. The Hogetza dredge is the one they bought from Livengood. It was a pontoon dredge, and they shipped that to Hogetza. And the Pedro dredge is at Chicken Creek, sitting in the lower Chicken Creek now.
Is it working at Chicken now?
No, Chicken is not working, but Hogetza is.
That dredge that I just mentioned that we can see from the Steese Highway just before you get to Fox, and it's used as a tourist attraction now.
That's the one that they've apparently sold to some of the businessmen of Fairbanks, and it's a tourist attraction. That would be...
That was one off of Goldstream then.
That's a 6-cubic-foot bucket that wound up on the left limit of Goldstream where it now sets.
Six-cubic-foot bucket. Is that how they
gauge the size of the dredge? They had two classes of dredges to start before they put the Pedro dredge in. The smaller dredge, what we call the smaller dredges, are 6-cubic-foot, and the larger ones are 10-cubic-foot. Goldstream, and the first dredge on Goldstream was the big one. It was moved then to Fairbanks Creek, where it now rests. That was dredge number two. Dredge number three was in Chattanooga in the deep ground. Those were, and also the Cripple Creek dredge. Those three were all 10-cubic-foot dredges.
Now that dredge that went to Fairbanks Creek, is that the one that was winched up over the hill?
It was cut in two and moved to Fairbanks Creek from Goldstream.
Yeah, and just went right over the hill, slowly, of course. But I remember that. That was quite a feat. Can you recall some of the names of people worked for you, who still live in Fairbanks, but worked for you at, well, we'll take time out here for a cup of coffee.
This is very, I'm going to make some fresh and...
Clausen Smith worked in the office.
She's...
Most of the others have moved away or passed away. Eartha Baker worked there for many years, of course, and was a very fine gal. And Norma worked in the accounting office, and she was a very fine worker.
Now,
oh, yes, there's one more. Agnes Herring Slofeldt.
Is that right?
She started in there right out of high school. She's a nice gal.
She really is. She's just so quiet. And
if I can help you at all, yell. I mean, I'm not being antisocial, but you've got something to do, so just call me if you want me.
Okay, I'm going to interview you another time. But we will. We'll call you if we need some help. Agnes Herring Slofeldt. Didn't Al Seeliger work for you, too?
Well, he didn't. Al Seeliger replaced Charlie Fowler, who was the employment service. And he worked for Fowler for a little while, then he became the employment service man. And that was up in the front. Sure, I was the office manager, but then really what I was talking about was the accounting office. I had a number of people back there. And then the engineering office was upstairs, Most of my work was in the accounting and, well, looking after the gold. I think I weighed every bar of gold they had while I was there.
Is that right? How many millions of dollars worth of gold went through your
hands? I really have no idea. I could tell by looking at the accounts, but I really wouldn't even guess at it now. I mean, gold was just a commodity to me. I mean, it...
Well, they had a gold room in the back of the...
Yes, in the building. They had
a furnace
which was had served a dual purpose. They put the cleanup in the furnace and clamped the lid down and started up at a low heat and drive the quicksilver off. And as soon as
evaporated off?
As soon as the quicksilver was driven off, and you could tell by the water cooled pipe it came down, quit dripping it for a while, they'd take the top off and turn up the heat and melt the gold in the same crucible.
And then they'd pour it off into...
Pour it off in iron molds.
In molds.
If you had a good clean-up, you might get three or four bricks out of one pot, and on the poorer clean-ups, you'd only get one.
What would one brick weigh?
Oh, I don't think any of them were more than 100 pounds, 80 to 100 pounds, because more than that in gold is not easy to handle. I mean, sure, anybody can lift 80 or 100 pounds, most anybody, but gold is a concentrated weight, and they didn't want to get them too big. At the old $20 price, it was probably $30,000, just roughly.
Okay, was gold... $20 an ounce when you came here in 1928?
$20.67 was the old standard, yes.
$20.67
an ounce. That was the government price, and money was tied to it, and it was the standard all over the world, really.
When I talked to Ed Geno the other day, he was telling me that when he first went into the 40 mile, that, of course, this was 1904, 5, 6, they were getting $16 an ounce for gold.
Well, the miners did use that method, and gold was $16 an ounce, because that is what they got for an ounce of the gold they produced, and gold's value is determined by the fineness of the gold that they produce. Now,
the purity, you mean, or the...
No, gold, all gold has some silver in it, Mike.
I see.
And it usually, the fineness of the gold is determined by the... Well, 900 fine is, or 900 to 950 is very fine gold, because 1,000 fine is pure gold. And in this area, most of the gold the company had was from, none of it was lower than 850 fine, I don't believe. I mean, regular cleanups.
Oh, I see.
And ran from that to above, a little above 900. So the difference in between 1,000 fine and 850 or 900 is mostly silver, all gold and silver. You recover them by the same methods, and they are akin. That's not the mining term, but then that's what they are.
Right.
I mean, when you find one, you find the other. In a silver mine, you find a little bit of gold, but not much. In a gold mine, you find some silver. Sometimes, now in Arizona, where I worked at a gold mine, the gold there was not yellow. It was only about 500 or 600 fine, and there's lots of silver in it. So that is the history of it.
I see. Something I didn't know. Of course, there's lots I don't know, but I...
Well, I don't know
too
much.
You know, my husband mined gold for many years, but I've never heard this.
I'm sure Mike knows all about their... Jim knows all about this.
Oh, of course he does, but it's just something that I've never run across before.
Of course, in the States, the gold mines I worked at were lode mines, and they broke the rock and crammed it to the mill and recovered it by usually a cyanide method if it was free milling, and if not, why, by... more elaborate method, but the cyanide method had first was the old Pachuca tanks, great big tanks, you know, and finally they got it down so they didn't need those big tanks, and had a start off with, they had a 72-hour circuit to get the gold out of it after it was ground up fine, but they've improved that a lot. In fact, there are no more mines to prove it on hardly.
But the Fairbanks Exploration Company didn't use this process.
It was all placer.
This is
they
placer
had,
gold,
yes.
So
they had. Well, the only lode mine they ever had, they had McCarty mine for a little while, they got from Gene Schreiber, but that was just a small thing. I mean, it didn't amount to very much, really.
So the Hogatsa dredge is the only dredge that's operating right now?
Right, at the present time.
And that's the U.S. smelting.
Of course, the U.S. smelting does have ground and dredges setting in Nome, but that was a different operation. I mean, it was all U.S. smelting, but a different operation.
Mm-hmm. What's the status of this Cripple Creek dredge? Is it just buttoned up for future use, or is it going... I know that there are big signs that say no admittance and so on and so forth. But
since it's been 15 years since I was with the company, and the company's headquarters were in Boston when I was with them, they are now... headquarters are in New York, and there's only two people with the company that I really know personally that were with the old U.S. Smelting Company. It has been taken over by New York people, and they moved the office there, and it even changed the name. I think it's called AV Industries now.
Just initials AV?
AV, yes. Or is it VA? I don't remember now. I get a retirement check from them, but but they've even changed the name and moved to New York, and they have other industries. I mean, gold mining is a very, or mining is a very small part of their operation, really. It's, they spread their money out in various industries.
Do you think there is any possibility that there, some of these dredges might get geared up again now with the rise in price of gold?
That's always a possibility, but the reserve of ground here is not really great. Nome has quite a lot of reserve there, but to get dredges rehabilitated, get the ground prepared, is a long-term deal, really, and not in, I don't mean 10 or 20 years, but it takes a number of years and lots of money. The dredges have been sitting idle for a long time, and to rehabilitate them, and you'd have to have new parts and lots of things fixed up because vandalism and age has deteriorated most of it.
And the ground, you'd have to prepare the ground by a lot of it thawing it?
If you have frozen ground, you would have to thaw the ground, and that takes quite a little time on deep ground. The cold water thawing takes 2 or 3 years, and if it has an overburden on it, you have to strip that off first and then thaw the ground. If you're fortunate enough to have thawed ground with decent values in it, why, it saves you a lot of money. Cripple Creek was thawed ground, by the way, and that was the richest ground the company ever had. They didn't, well, they didn't own it. They never did own it. It was a royalty deal. Barry, Jessen, and Hamill were the three families that owned it, most of it.
And they retire on their royalties and go south?
Well, they have plenty of royalties, and they still own the ground. It's all patented ground.
I see. Mm-hmm. My husband plus quite a few others who went to the University of Alaska worked for the Fairbanks Exploration Company.
Yeah.
And Earl Beislein is the president of the IGLU now. Did he work for you or work for your company when you worked there?
Yes, Earl worked for the FE company, and I recall him very well. He was on the gold cleanup crew working for Johnny O'Shea, who was in charge of the
cleanup. Oh, I know Johnny
crew.
O'Shea.
And later on, Joe Thomas was on it, too. But at the time Earl started then, I think Johnny O'Shea was in charge of it.
Yeah, I just read recently where John O'Shea is now the
Commissioner of Insurance
in the state of Alaska. Yeah,
he's a good man. Yeah,
yeah. He's one of my husband's favorite college friends.
Yeah,
they always get together. Who else do you remember who might be in the Pioneers right now who might be active? Did Bruce, for example, Bruce Thomas, did he work for?
Bruce Thomas worked mostly for the Live and Good people, and he was in charge of the Live and Good mining for a while. I don't know that Bruce ever worked for the FE company. He may have, but I didn't know him at that time, really.
One thing that surprised me in 1970 was then-Governor Keith Miller. He said he worked for FE company in 1949, 1950, maybe two seasons.
You know, at the height of operations, the FE company would have from 1,200 to 1,400 people in working in the summer.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah. Construction wasn't finished and the operations were starting. 1,200 to 1,400 people would be the maximum number they would have. Of course, it was seasonal for most of them.